Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is a retired federal magistrate judge from the Western District of Michigan. His name is Hugh Brenneman. Well, he has a number of hats and talents, and we're going to be talking about that. But one of the things we want to talk about is his knowledge of the history of the Western District of the state of Michigan in the federal court system, or the or even before the federal court system. And I think you'll find that there's a number of fascinating things that we learn about pioneer America, as well as from then until now in the Western District of Michigan. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to Hugh Brenneman with Respect, and we'll be right back. So, Hugh, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, John.
Good.
Thank you.
Good. All right. Everybody has to know, on our guest, where did you come from originally?
Well, I was born in Ingham County, Michigan, the center of the state. Grew up in East Lansing, Michigan. And then I went in different directions, an hour north to Alma College, an hour east to the University of Michigan Law School in Ann Arbor. And after some military service, I came back and moved an hour west to Grand Rapids, where I spent the rest of my life.
You were a lawyer, obviously, because you're a magistrate judge, but how did that all come about? Was that something you really wanted to be? Did you inherit it from your family and GNA like I did? You know, my father, my grandfather, my father, my uncles, and all that were lawyers, and so it's a DNA failing. All right, it's an aberration.
Well, my father worked as a public relations counsel for the State Bar of Michigan, along with some other jobs, and we have a little connection with the legal profession, but he was not an attorney. Mm-hmm. I think that I probably talked myself into it. In high school, when people would ask me, well, what do you want to do with your life? Where are you headed? And I found that if I said, well, I want to be a lawyer, they would pat me on the head, figuratively speaking. They were satisfied, and they'd go away. So after a while, I just said, you know, this isn't bad. And I liked the things that a lawyer does. We had a debate team, learn how to give speeches, study history, and study people in social studies. And so that was really my area of interest. I was probably stronger in that area than I was in mathematics or science, which might have sent me into the medical profession or to become an architect. So it was just natural to keep going in that direction. And so immediately after college, I went to law school. Everybody went to graduate school right after college, or they went into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't in the law school more than a few months, and they did away with draft deferments.
Mm.
Which is how I'd been able to be there. So I went down the next morning with everybody else in the class on the Monday morning following, and we all enlisted in the ROTC or the National Guard or some other military institution that would enable us to finish our legal education. And so I became a reserve commissioned officer in the Army at the same time I graduated from law school. And after a short wait to go on active duty when I became a law clerk for a while and a deputy sheriff. Then I went into the JAG Corps, mm-hmm. the Army JAG Corps, and I was there for about 4 years.
JAG Corps is Judge Advocate General, which is the legal part of the department, the various
right.
military services.
That's correct, and each branch has a JAG Corps. So I was in the Army JAG Corps, and they send you down to school in Charlottesville, Virginia. You've just graduated from law school, but they send you back to military law school to learn the military aspect of the law. Then I was stationed in several places, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a good job. I was a defense counsel. I was a prosecutor, And then they put me in charge of Chief of Military Justice, where I was stationed. And then I went to Washington, D.C. to do appellate work. But I wanted to try my hand in the real world. And so when I got out, I wasn't married. I didn't have any specific place to go, but I wanted to stay with the federal law. So I investigated the U.S. Attorney's offices. And you're familiar with the U.S. Attorney's office, since mm-hmm. you were one.
Yep.
So I came back to West Michigan, and there was a slot available at the U.S. Attorney's office in Grand Rapids. There were only four assistants at that time, as you're well aware, but I don't know if your listeners would be. There are 94 federal districts in this country. Michigan has two of them. They're based on geographic necessity. And so Michigan has two. And each one of these districts has a United States attorney appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, which you were.
Mm-hmm.
And then that person will have a number of assistant U.S. attorneys, depending on the caseload. And at the time I joined the office, there were four assistant positions. I think they're up to 36 now. Crime has expanded, or the mm-hmm. duties have expanded. I don't know quite what. But it was a very good job, one of the best jobs in the legal profession, I think. And then after that, I wanted to try private practice. I never expected to stay there permanently, but it was a good entree into West Michigan and Grand Rapids. So I went into private practice for several years, and then a position opened up on the court, which allowed me to become a federal magistrate, and then the title changed later to magistrate judge.
Mm.
That happened about 10 years later, not because the job changed at all, but people didn't know quite what a magistrate was, which means judge if you look it up.
That's right.
Congress one day on the spur of the moment said, well, let's make this clear. Let's add the term judge. So you might call us United States Judge. That title has stuck ever since.
But Redundant, but effective.
You say it enough times and somebody understands what it is. And I stayed with that position for the next 35 years until I retired about 4 years ago.
Well, that's a wide-ranging a path that you took to get to where you're at. And now you've been retired for how long?
4 years.
All right. Well, let me go back one step. Do you have any brothers, sisters?
No.
All right. And your dad was in what kind of a business?
He was an association executive. Mm-hmm. He ran the Michigan State Medical Society for a number of years. But before he did that, he was in public relations for them before mm-hmm. he became the executive director. And at the same time, he did public relations for the State Bar of Michigan, as well as a variety of other similar professional organizations. And in fact, he started an organization called the Michigan Association of the Professions, which combined all of the professional groups together into one.
Mm-hmm.
And you could join that either as an individual member or the associations themselves joined. So the State Medical Society, the professional engineers, the veterinarians, the dentists, they all joined the Michigan Association of the Professions, which furthered professional interests.
All right. You know, everybody comes to the law for or to whatever career or life, however life deals them cards, with some idea. Now, you've talked about you finding the law interesting. What about the law itself? When you got into it, did you find the most interesting? Was it the same thing as you anticipated? When you were studying to be a lawyer, did you kind of develop better ideas of what the law is all about?
I think I realized as I got into it how complex and diverse it is. Of course, we're all familiar with criminal law because that's what the movies and the TV shows are all about.
Mm-hmm.
A greater portion of my duties was also commercial law and intellectual property law, contracts. And then there'd be the discrimination actions and that sort of thing. But even as a judge, I was constantly learning about new federal statutes. And, of course, the federal courts are concerned mostly with federal statutes, so you'd think we would be familiar with all of them. But there are just a huge number of them out there, even federal agencies we don't even know about sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they all seem to have a law enforcement component to them, and so we'd be seeing a new case every once in a while. It was always a challenge to be familiar with all of the different aspects. And so you never get bored. You never. Now, that's maybe right. As a practitioner, and you've had some experience, of course, as a practitioner, you can get too narrowly focused, and I don't know. But as a judge, you don't get narrowly focused. There's always something new on your plate, literally every half hour, it seems like.
You know, it's interesting you mention that because for some years I was in a sole practice. That is, my practice was myself and my assistant, Joanne. And then gradually, as the business expanded, as my work kept coming in, I ended up taking a wide range of things and brought in three more partners. And literally, at one point, we decided there wasn't anything we weren't doing, except we didn't want any bankruptcy and we didn't want any tax tax cases. And as life happens to you, it's like my daughter when she wanted to be a cheerleader. And she was, she is and was a great athlete. Although she will, when she hears this, she will harumph. but the one thing, she was going to be a cheerleader. And I thought, oh my God, a cheerleader? I want her to be out there in the basketball court. I mean, this cheerleading is easy. Oh no. The Lord gives you what you don't think you want, but it turns out to be for the better. I watched them in practices and in tournaments and games and whatnot, and it's a very demanding field of endeavor. It is a tough thing to watch those kids out there and doing, practicing and doing things, tricks and acrobatics and whatnot.
Absolutely. I have to insert that I said I went to Alma College. They have a cheer team up there, and that's where I first got exposed to the extent to which these, they call them kids, but students are just tremendous athletes, and they really get involved in some things that we never dreamed of when we saw our cheerleaders.
Yeah. So, all right. When I got into the law, in the practice of law, I had a choice. I either could stay with my father's firm in Chicago, or I could branch out and do something on my own, which is, you know, I was young. I was going to do something on my own. So I came to Berrien County, became an assistant prosecutor here for a short time so I can get some trial experience and then go back. Oh, no, that's not how life worked. I fell stone cold in love with prosecution when I was, after about 2 weeks of seeing what prosecutors, the variety of life that they would come in contact with. And while it is not as complicated in the sense that, you know, patent law or copyright law or taxes or whatnot, still the variety of human experiences that you come into every day was remarkable, absolutely remarkable.
And didn't you find as a prosecutor that you had the opportunity to do what was right or what you perceived as being right? You didn't have to bring a case.
Absolutely.
You could say, well, there was some mistakes made there, but that's not something that should be prosecuted, or that is something that should be prosecuted.
That's right. That's
the defense
exactly
counsel
right.
is stuck with the whatever they're faced with, whatever the crime is, but not the prosecutor.
Well, also, you know, you look at the civil side of the law, and attorneys represent civil clients, whether they're great big corporations or they're neighbors who are having a difficulty over drainage systems. But they have to be guided, the attorneys on either side have to be guided by their clients' desires within the rules of professional ethics. Whereas a prosecutor, as you point out, has not only the opportunity to do justice, regardless of what the cops think, regardless of what other people in the system think, and regardless what the judges think, bless their souls, but they have the obligation to do justice and to play fair, whereas the defense counsel are not under that. They're under an obligation to defend their clients within the law, within the rules, but fiercely and thoroughly.
Well, the judge goes one step better in some respects because the judge can set aside the premonitions of either side. The judge can sit on either side to, even tell the prosecutor, you've gone too far.
That's right.
The judges cannot require a prosecutor to prosecute anything.
Right.
But if they bring a case and they're overly zealous, that's some place that the judge might step in. When you talk about trying to do what's just and what's proper and what's right, as only individuals can see that, of course, the judge, I think, is in probably the best place to do that. Well, they have to take only things that are presented to them. They cannot choose what's presented to them like the prosecutor can.
Although I've had situations where judges decided to do just that. There are cases and situations in which they decided to be their own prosecutor or their own defense attorney.
Well, that's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. But in some places, the law provides for it. So at any rate, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to retired magistrate judge Hugh Brenneman of the Western District of Michigan. And we're going to be talking in a bit about the history of this fascinating part of the country as far as the law is concerned and the people that come here and have been here over the years. This is John Smetankert, One With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Magistrate Judge Hugh Brenneman of the Western District of Michigan, now retired for 4 years, but his mind is still functioning. This is good. That means he's keeping busy. And we're talking about the Western District of Michigan, not only historically, but also as sort of a model for how we can look at the development of law over a period of centuries. This is John Smetanka. So, Hugh, we left off and we were talking about how our experiences and how judges function and whatnot. But I want to you also have another title in your retirement, but it's not just when you're in retirement, but before you started. The Historical Society of the Western District of Michigan, and you've been a great contributor to an understanding of the history of our district. So why don't you tell us about what does this district look like that you know we're going to be talking about?
Well, the District of Michigan, as I indicated, there are 94 federal districts around the country. There are two in Michigan because of the population and geographic necessities. If you take the state of Michigan, which looks like a mitten in the lower peninsula, and then another mitten that is in the upper peninsula, and the two come together and at the Mackinac Bridge, but the lower peninsula looks like a mitten. And if you draw a line straight down the middle of that, everything west of that line over to Lake Michigan and the entire upper peninsula are part of the Western District of Michigan. A tremendous amount of shoreline. There's more shoreline than in any other district in the country, with the exception of Alaska. It's a very diverse district. It's got big cities. It's got rural areas. It's got national forests, national parks, Indian reservations.
Military bases.
It's had military bases. It grows fruit and vegetables down here in the Southwest that will rival any place, but the hunting and fishing up north rivals any place. So it's quite a diverse group. It might be helpful to give a little background of where the district courts come from. If I could take you back for just a moment to the founding of our country, of course, after the Revolutionary War, the colonies kind of went their own way for a while under the Articles of Confederation. There wasn't much national interest, but that didn't work well. So, of course, we had the federal constitution drafted, and that was adopted. And that provided for a federal government with a court system. And we had not had a court system under the Articles of Confederation, which preceded that. We had left the judicial aspects to the individual states. But the founders of the country, the founding fathers, as we call them, it should be founding fathers and mothers, but the term is founding fathers, decided that we have some federal interests that need federal protection and federal adjudication. And so they decided to have a Supreme Court, and that's provided for in the Constitution. And that's the final authority in any federal matter that's brought before it. The Constitution also provides for such inferior courts as Congress may establish. Now, I think that's in an ill-chosen word, inferior courts, but that's the word in the Constitution. So they set up a district court, a federal district court, in each one of the 13 states at that time. And they assigned a judge to each one of those courts, as well as one federal prosecutor, one U.S. attorney in each of those districts to represent the government's interests. And that was our federal judicial system. They also set up, however, some circuit courts that no longer exist. And the circuit court would consist of the district judge and two Supreme Court justices that would travel to that district and hear appeals from lower courts, from the district judge, actually. And that was a circuit court. And that system was adopted with each new state that came into existence, or some variation of that system. They fine-tuned it as time went on. We are part of what was called the Northwest Territory. Northwest Territory was something that the United States received after the Revolutionary War from Britain. They conceded everything to us north of west of the Ohio River, which includes the Great Lakes and the present states of Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin and Minnesota.
And Illinois.
I don't want to forget Illinois, particularly since they're right next door to where you are today.
That's right.
So what the Congress envisioned was that with the Northwest Ordinance adopted in 1789, was that area would be divided into states eventually, three to five states, as the population grew. But there wasn't any real European heritage population in that area. But the settlers began to move westward. They needed more land. They wanted to have farms. There was not enough room on the East Coast. So they went west of the Alleghenies, and not without some incidents with the Native Americans who were there and didn't want to see them there. And the British, even though they had conceded the area, didn't want to see the Americans move west either, and they worked with the Indians to prevent that for a long time. But eventually, it became clear that was going to be American territory open to American settlers. And Ohio and Indiana and Illinois eventually had enough populations where they would be deemed states. And initially, there was one territorial government, and then as the states were formed out of that territorial government, you started to have smaller territories. And each territory, including the Michigan Territory, would start out with a governor and three judges, and that was it. And together they would be the legislature. And then eventually, as they got to, around 60,000 people, the area could have its own legislature, the three judges, and the governor. So your first courts in those territories were territorial courts. Now, the judges for those courts were appointed by the President of the United States, and Jefferson appointed a number of those. And he certainly appointed the first ones in Michigan. And the Michigan Territory generally was larger than the geographical state of Michigan today. At one point, it included all of Wisconsin, all of Minnesota, east of the Mississippi River. And at one point, it even included parts of the Dakotas for a brief period of time. Mm. And I think Iowa as well. But basically, the Michigan Territory was everything northwest of Detroit over to Minnesota. At that point, Michigan starts having enough population to become a state. But Michigan had a less population than the states below us, south of us, because the people moved west, but they moved west and bypassed Michigan.
Mm.
Michigan was perceived to be swampy. It was perceived to be a place the British might come back to very quickly because they'd already come back in the War of 1812 and reasserted their presence. They captured Mackinac Island in that war, and they tried to attack Detroit and so forth. So people were afraid of the British. Also, with the Ice Age, when the Ice Age came in Michigan, it came down about halfway down the lower peninsula, and it scraped off a lot of the topsoil. So when the ice receded, there wasn't much topsoil north of the middle of Michigan. And so it wasn't good for the type of crops that the farmers wanted to grow.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for pine trees, but not so good for vegetables, fruits and vegetables. This area, which is southwest Michigan, where we are now, and Detroit developed quite well. But north of this area, there wasn't too much. But Eventually, with the Erie Canal opening up the West, the Yankees from the Northeast and the Western Yankees from New York State all moved west into Michigan. We became Yankee Land. We were called Yankee Land for a while.
Mm.
And in 1830s, Grand Rapids was only had a few thousand people. But if you were to take your map of Michigan, and I tell everybody to bring out their map of Michigan, which, of course, is their right hand. And if you put a dot right in the middle of your palm, that's Lansing. And you draw a line westward, that's the Grand River. And if you were to split that line in half, halfway between Lansing and Lake Michigan, and then draw another line going northeast, basically everything north and west of that line that you've just drawn on your hand was Indian territory, which was part of the Northwest Territory and under the United States government. But the law provided that until the Indians surrendered that land by treaty to the United States would not survey it. And until it was surveyed, it could not be sold to any settlers. And the settlers had to buy their land from the United States. So until about 1836, I should be speaking about 1836, the land north of Grand Rapids and west all the way through the Upper Peninsula had not been by treaty obtained from the Native Americans. So it was not surveyed by the government, federal government, and it was not sold. 1837, we became a state, and about the same time, there was a treaty, and the Indians sold off all that land to the United States government. And then it was sold off to the settlers, and the settlers now moved up into Michigan. Our population increased drastically. We became a state. We had a small squabble with Ohio over who should have Tennessee.
Small squabble was the famous war between Michigan and Ohio, which has been replicated for two centuries now, is a fight between University of Michigan and Ohio State University. But it was actually a war. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a point they were fighting over this little strip of land, which is north of Indiana, and it was right on Lake Erie.
Yes, and north of Ohio, right.
But it was right. It touched Lake Erie.
Yes.
And by God, they wanted, Ohio wanted that.
That's Toledo. That's where Toledo is.
Yes, the city of Toledo.
Yeah.
Now, then after that, I mean, there was an army that marched down from Michigan into Ohio to take, you can't take the Maumee Strip or the Toledo Strip. Can't do that. And luckily for all of us, they failed because as a compromise, did we not get not just the Michigan below Mackinac, but that whole upper peninsula came over from Wisconsin. They broke up Wisconsin and gave us that.
That's correct.
That land became one of the wealthiest parts of the United States for a period of time because it had copper and copper and iron.
Iron. Mm-hmm.
And they mined that, and there was some of the wealthiest communities in the United States were on the Keweenaw Peninsula, which sticks up into Lake Superior.
Oh, yes. We came out ahead on that deal. With all due respect to Toledo, they got Toledo, and we got the Upper Peninsula.
That's right.
But until,
I'll take that any day.
But until we agreed to that, and there was a lot of fight about a lot of people in Michigan didn't want to agree to that. Ohio blocked our entrance into the United States. And after all, they had two United States senators because they were already a state. We didn't have anybody. And so we were not going to become a state. And I think we had the legislature wouldn't confirm that Toledo should go to Ohio. But then somebody formed an ad hoc group, some kind of a convention that decided they'd vote on it again. And they voted on it again and said, yeah, let them have it. And we'll settle this. And they became a state. And nobody was killed in that war, incidentally. It's, it's one of the better wars, I suppose, relatively speaking, that nobody died.
Mm-hmm.
But it's become very famous, certainly around between Michigan and Ohio.
I'm sure that you know this, but just to focus it for our listeners, the distance between the Detroit area, the Michigan boundary at Ohio, and the farthest point on the Upper Peninsula is about 750 miles. And if you look at another part of our mission, which is the Eye of Lake Superior, Isle Royal, add on some miles to that. Mm-hmm. And even our western district, if you take from the Indiana border up to those same places, it's about 700 miles driving. It is maybe shorter, a little shorter by air, but these are large areas. One of my guests from Britain on the show recognized that he looked at the map and he said, "This is a big state," and I said, "Yeah, it is." So he took out a map and he kind of put it on top of the Michigan map, and he realized that if you take in the whole state of Michigan, it is larger than the entire main British island, Scotland, Wales, England.
I always wondered about that.
Yes, they are. Yes, it is.
Well, so I just learned something. Thank you.
And that's not even putting Ireland into it. And this is it's an amazing thing. In fact, friends of mine, every single European friend of mine who's come to the United States, whatever idea they had about the Great Lakes before or about anything west of New York, was included. Well, you've got lakes, the Great Lakes. What are the Great Lakes? And they all come to the beach, and they stand out, and they look across the water, and they say to their spouses, they say, "My God, it's like an ocean." And it's the same line that is repeated over and over and over again. "My God, it's like an ocean," which is true. And it also had an effect on us and our law, did it not?
Well, I think it did, and obviously there was an awful lot of shipping around the Great Lakes, and that, in fact, that was the way people moved.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't go inland because of the forests, and there weren't any roads, but they could travel on the waterways.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you talk about the Upper Peninsula and the Keweenaw Peninsula, that became very developed, and they had a beautiful opera house up there long mm-hmm. before anything in the interior part of Michigan got developed.
We're going to talk more about this because it's so interesting, but we're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka, run with respect, and our guest is Magistrate Judge, retired, Hugh Brenneman, who is also the historian for the Western District of Michigan, Western Federal District Court of Michigan. And we're talking about the history and the geography of this huge state that we have. This is John Smetanka, run with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Magistrate Judge Hugh Brenneman, now retired, who is the historian for the legal organization called the Western District of Michigan here in our area. But we're talking about how, up now, we've been setting the stage. We're talking about how we in Michigan became a state, what it looks like, and we're now going to talk about how the law got applied in this area. So this is John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Hugh, this is a large area. And before there were superhighways, before there were even roads, there was necessity for people to get to from their farms into mm-hmm. a place where they could deliver their crops. How people could get to where this land that they had bought from the federal government was located. But as soon as you put people together and you put businesses together, you have human conflict.
Yes.
What kind of things do you remember from the, not remember, I should say, have researched? All right. You're not that old.
Thank you.
Have researched concerning the history of the law in the western area of Michigan.
Well, several things are striking. One is the geographical area. And we're not as big as Texas or Alaska, but as you mentioned, we're quite large.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have some outposts in Sault Ste. Marie, Mackinac Island, and Green Bay, and Prairie du Chien, which is on the Mississippi River. Those were all parts of the Michigan Territory initially. And we had three judges down in Detroit. Well, those people had conflicts in those various areas, even though there weren't a lot of people in between. So how do they get their matters resolved? They would have to come all the way down to Detroit. And in fact, they could be gone 6 months if they left in the fall and the ice froze over and they couldn't get back until spring. So they needed a judge up north. And none of the territorial judges, the three appointed by Jefferson and his successors down in Detroit, had any desire to travel north by canoe or barge or some other vessel like that to these places. So it became quite difficult for the witnesses and the parties and the lawyers to come down. So Congress created another judge up there for the what's called Brown County, Michilimackinac County, and one other county up there. So to hear cases, they needed that other judge. Congress didn't give that judge a name. They called him the additional judge. And they didn't give his court a name. They called it the additional court. But they were additional to the territorial court. But that was a federal judge being appointed by a president who had complete control on the criminal docket. There was no appeal from his decisions. And there were hanging offenses up there, capital offenses that he had to adjudicate. So that just tells you, I think, or illustrates perhaps, how widespread this area was and how difficult it was to travel. And the first judge to do that was Judge James Duane Doty. Judge Doty would travel between Prairie du Chien on the upper Mississippi to Green Bay to Mackinac Island and hold court in each one of those places each year. As a result, that when we became a state, we had some of the same problems. And it was very difficult for people in Grand Rapids, for example, to get to Detroit where the court was. There had been a major road from this area in southwest Michigan, where we are, St. Joseph County and Berrien County, to Detroit. But there was nothing from Grand Rapids to speak of. And that caused us to look to become a separate district. We became a separate district in 1863 during the middle of the Civil War when Lincoln proclaimed this would be a separate district. And that allowed us to open up a federal court in Grand Rapids, which made it a lot easier for the people on the west side of the state to get to a federal court.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Congress had created, because this problem was unique not just to us, but it was quite common, states and districts all over the United States. So you had to have people who could handle bail and other small matters like that when they couldn't get to a district judge and they couldn't travel through the forest and so forth. So they created the position that became known as a commissioner, which is the predecessor of my position as a federal magistrate judge. When the commissioners were created 4 years after the Constitution was adopted, they didn't have a name for the judge. Congress apparently doesn't like to give names. They didn't give that individual any name or title. They just said that person ought to be a discreet person learned in the law. And you could have a number of those people stationed out in the hinterland who could take bail and handle matters for the federal court until the case could get to the district judge. I will note that there is no other position provided for in the federal statutes that requires a discreet person learned in the law. Prosecutors back then were called meat persons, but that would mean they were qualified, but I always like that learned in the law part. The district judges didn't have that title. The position continued to grow in duties and responsibilities. Eventually it became the magistrate judges, which is what I am. We're part of the federal district court.
Now, there are famous cases, at least famous in our area, which, you know, play out the situation of having to travel great distances across the lakes and up through the woods and whatnot. And it also illustrates the central importance of Mackinac Island. That's now one of the great resorts in the world. But back in the day, it was a British fort. It was an American fort. It was a British fort. It was an American fort, and so on, controlling the Straits of Mackinac. But that later, when we finally got control of our own borders from the lovely British, that trading area, yes, became an important legal venue. But I remember you have telling a story once about a murder trial, as I recall, that was involved a lot, yes, of travel.
Yes, that was. I know what you're talking about. There was a fellow, a private up at the fort in the American Army, who discharged his weapon in the dining hall as he was supposedly cleaning it to go on duty, and shot and killed a sergeant. It might have been an accident, except that those two had words earlier in the day. So it was looked upon as an intentional act, and the private was put in the jail that the military had. And in those days, the military didn't try cases like that. They would try, I suppose, AWOL cases or desertion cases or disobeying an order, but they didn't try common law criminal cases. I think perhaps there was a fear that the military would revert back to what the British had been, because the British military had been very dominating. In any event, this was to be tried by a civilian, and James Duane Doty, who I mentioned, who was the first additional judge up in that area, was to try the case on Mackinac Island. And he got to Mackinac Island, and they had to have a grand jury, because the federal courts required a grand jury to determine if there should be an indictment brought. So he impaneled a grand jury. The grand jury met, and they indicted this man on a murder charge, this private who had shot the other person in the mess hall. Then Doty impaneled a regular jury to try the case. He called it a petite jury, or trial jury. They then tried the case, attorneys on both sides. The man was convicted. Doty sentenced him to be hanged. There was a motion brought to set aside the entire proceedings because the jurors hadn't been properly qualified in the first place. Doty granted the motion, and this all took place in one day.
You're kidding. One day.
They're very efficient. And as I said, if you read the transcripts, what there are of them, and you read the proceedings, they're very proper under the law. And the law, mm-hmm, you know, there's a common law of England brought through our other states. And
you know, if you start from the formation of the Constitution of the United States, and we inherited, by our choice, some parts of the law from England that we had just gotten rid of, and but if you start from all this history you've described, we've added more and more procedures to regularize these criminal cases, and, you know, civil cases as well. But you have the grand jury deciding whether a crime was committed, a trial jury deciding is the person actually guilty, mm-hmm, beyond a reasonable doubt. And then sometime after that, we have pre-sentence investigations, and all this can take months today.
Yes, it can.
But this was done in one day.
In one day. And so the judge decided that the jury had not been picked correctly, so he assigns the sheriff, who was a guy named Biddle, to go out and round up another jury. Well, Sheriff Biddle, who, by the way, was a member of a very prominent family on the East Coast, the Biddle family is still prominent today, but he'd come out to make his fortune, mm-hmm, and there were many prominent people came to to Mackinac Island. So Biddle tells the judge there are not enough people left on the island who can qualify as jurors. So Doty decided to move the case to Green Bay. So they all packed up, got in their canoes, and paddled down to Green Bay, where another grand jury was picked. They arrived at the same result, indicted this man. There was a trial. Another jury was picked to try the case. That jury came back unanimously guilty. And again, Doty had to impose the sentence of death by hanging. They then came back to Mackinac Island. Now, this man that was the criminal defendant had two attorneys. And they raised a number of challenges, very good challenges. But there was no appeal from Doty's decision. He was the final court. There was no appellate court at that time, not even the Supreme Court. So their appeal, in effect, went to Andrew Jackson. And he was the president of the United States. And it was kind of a plea for mercy, but supported by legal arguments. Now, there may be a president out there who would be sympathetic toward this situation. Andrew Jackson was not that man.
Mm-hmm. And a general, had been a general.
Yes. And
Battle of New Orleans.
So this was a military matter. One man had killed another. Two juries had found him guilty. And Jackson did nothing to change the result. That word came back to Mackinac Island, and the man had to be told that he had no future avenues of appeal. And eventually, he was on orders of the court. He was hanged by Sheriff Biddle, and it was not a popular decision. On the in the decision, the result was everybody agreed with the result, but not what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
That he would be hanged. The people on Mackinac Island didn't want to see anybody hanged on Mackinac Island. But Biddle had his duty, and that's what happened. And he's now buried in the same graveyard on Mackinac Island that the man he killed is.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, a military graveyard up there.
It's these kinds of things which strike me as the human parts of the law that becomes something of serious interest. And you can imagine if you've ever been to Mackinac Island, you can imagine taking the ferry over, and it's a whole new world. It's like a quiet retreat house when you get over there. But that passageway, 5 miles or so,
mm-hmm.
From the upper peninsula, the lower peninsula, up to Mackinac Island, has all kinds of history to it. And you imagine these people paddling around in canoes. There could be very rough weather up there. I mean, I've been in Mackinac.
Absolutely.
Island. It is tough. I have stories about that. But anyway, we're going to come back in a minute, but right now we're going to take a break. We're talking to Magistrate Judge Hugh Brenneman, and this is John Smetanka. We're talking about the history of the Federal District of Court and the Western District of Michigan. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Magistrate Judge Hugh Brenneman, a retired magistrate, but also the historian for the Western District of Michigan legal history. So, this is John Smetanka. Now, all right, Hugh, there are other factors, other people, other things which happened here that are unique. And do you have any others that you wanted to talk about?
Well, a couple come to mind, John. I might follow up. The man that had to tell the prisoner, in that case I was just telling you about, that he was going to be hanged, was a man named Reverend Ferry, who had been sent there to start a school for the Indians. And he had been sitting with the prisoner in his cell every day and trying to counsel him and convert him to Christ. Interestingly, Ferry had several children, born on Mackinac Island. One was Thomas Ferry, who became a United States Senator eventually.
Well, be darned.
And not only that, he became pro tem was the word, in the United States Senate, which at that time put him second in line to become president if the vice president died and the president died. And Grant was the president, President Grant, and his vice president did die. And he was never replaced for about 9 months. And so for about 9 months, Thomas Ferry, born on Mackinac Island at the same time as this story, was next in line to be president of the United States, a fact most people don't know about.
It's an interesting thing, because when I worked in Washington in the main justice for a couple of years, and I was in a position where if, everybody else was gone, about three levels ahead of above me,
yeah.
That I would have been in charge of the shop, so to speak. Well, as it happened, everybody in Washington gets out if they can in the summertime, in August. And there was one weekend when the attorney general was gone, the deputy attorney general was gone, and I was it. I was the next person. And the other thing is, people don't realize this, but there's a hidden little part tucked away in the laws of the United States when there's an emergency, a war in which the government is seriously destroyed in Washington, and mm-hmm. our communications are awful, and the civil authorities in Washington have to reorganize the whole country. The United States attorney for each district is the one who is the surrogate president of the United States for that area, for the Western District of Michigan. Yeah, it's tucked away, and it's fascinating. And I told this to somebody, and they ran for the hills. That's scary to have you in charge of this particular thing. No, anyhow.
I think we would be in very good hands, John. But in answer to your other question, we also were a part of the Underground Railroad before the Civil War. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Underground Railroad. Escaped slaves from the South would make their way north and try to get to Canada, where they would be free and couldn't be touched by their Southern owners. If they were recaptured en route, they could be brought back. In fact, the laws favored that. And so a number of them would make their way up into Michigan. In this area, Southwest Michigan, Marshall, Kalamazoo, and some other cities around here. And then they would head on the main road to Detroit or up to Port Huron and try to cross into Canada. Some of them would go up to Mackinac or up to Lake Michigan, not as many. If they were caught, they could be brought before a commissioner, which was the predecessor to my job, and the commissioners would have to rule on whether they should be returned to their owners down in the South, who would come up with proof that this person had been on a plantation, and they'd bring up their people to prove that. And there would be court proceedings. Well, that made it, that was a very unpleasant job for the commissioners. There was a commissioner who was also a professor at Harvard in Boston who ruled in favor of the owners from the South and was promptly fired as a law professor at Harvard. Mm. A very contentious time. And if for some reason if the Southerners could not regain their slaves, they could bring a lawsuit against the people that allowed them to escape and recover damages. And those cases would be tried in the federal courts. After the Civil War, the commissioners were in charge of enforcing the rights that the now freed slaves had. So they were the rights went the other direction of the Civil Rights Act back at that time. So a lot of that took place in this part of Michigan, and the magistrate, we weren't magistrate judges back then, the commissioners were our predecessors, but they were heavily involved in that. The records, unfortunately, are a little vague. They weren't kept that well.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you had a proceeding, you might have mobs of people. I mean, this part of the country is pretty anti-slave. Anti-slavery. So when somebody was captured up here, it was very difficult sometimes for the Southerners to remove the people from Michigan because local people would surround the courthouse or surround wherever they were and not let them go.
Mm-hmm.
But those people could then end up being sued in a federal court for the money that represented the value of the slave.
It's interesting because you're spot on the concept of this area being involved in the Underground Railroad. And even there were people who got off the Underground Railroad in places like Cass County and mm-hmm. St. Joseph and whatnot. But there was a community just north of here in Covert, which is very famous locally, and now its history is recorded in a book written by Annalisa Cox about that community, which was African-American, or very high percentage of African-American, who were free,
mm-hmm.
and they actually formed a multiracial community in which everybody basically got along, and there was not a division back in the day on racial grounds. Now, there was all kinds of reasons why it could have happened, such as the fact that the Michigan laws forbade at the time blacks and whites being educated together, forbade blacks from being in public office. And so these people both came in, both groups came in from one from the east with a religious group, and then those are the whites, and then the blacks came in from the south. And those people essentially ignored the law. And so when they made an annual report, when the superintendent of schools for Cass County made a report for Covert, made a report every year on the who was there, listed all the people who were there and never mentioned what their race was, contrary to the law. And they actually had African Americans in public office, elected by this community of blacks and whites. And so you had, as opposed to the misery that occurred down in the South with the conflict of the races after the Civil War, it was much different and much better here, because of this unique relationship that was developed before and during the Civil War.
I think you can't fail to underestimate the power of the public will. And if the laws are contrary to what the popular belief is, the popular will is, it's very difficult to enforce those laws, and people will find their way around it.
And that is absolutely correct. I'm a scholar and politician and government official, judges, one after the other, sometimes think that they can impose because they think that this is what the people need, a system which doesn't work. And whenever that happens, the result can be ineffective. They can be totally ineffective. And this goes all different ways, not just on racial issues or any kind of issue, but it's all different kinds of areas. It's an amazing piece of a country's psyche that the people have a great deal of wisdom built into them. And even when they're not completely wise, you still have to listen to them.
Well, that's why the jury system has become so important, because that expresses the thinking of the common person. When I say common person, I mean somebody who's not extremely familiar with what the law is, but you're asking them to make a decision rather than somebody who's perhaps over-sophisticated mm-hmm. and in what the law is. So the jury system generally gets the right answer. That's been our experience. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't want to see quite how they get there. It's kind of like watching sausage being made.
Absolutely.
But the bottom line is they come out with the right decision.
I've tried cases both as a prosecutor and as a private attorney. And I will tell you that in each of the cases, I have more confidence in the jury than I think I have in the judges. And when it comes to the understanding the humanity of a situation, because the judge is faced with having to apply a law, which sometimes is right there, black and white, and how do they go about without violating their oath to apply the law appropriately? How do they deal with those unique situations where the law is not popular, or we call those verdicts. What do they call it?
Nolle prost.
Pardon me.
Oh no, I know what.
where the verdict, they go outside the law.
Yes.
You know. Jury nullification, they call
it. Jury nullification. Not a popular word among judges.
That's right, it's not. But I remember in the day when juries were told they could not take notes. They could not ask questions during mm-hmm. the course of testimony. And that has changed. Now the courts around the country are saying, they've got a right to ask questions. Now, you can control, the judge can control in good order how they go about it, how they go about dealing with a question they have of a witness. But they can't stop them. And unfortunately, we are now out of time. And I want to invite you back because we've only gotten to the 1830s so far.
That's right.
There's so many other stories and concepts that we can draw about from the history of the Western District of Michigan. We can draw many different things about how law is practiced in areas which are, for a while, primitive or rural. And it really makes a difference. For example, what kind of people are there? You know, the surprising thing is there's many people who are very sophisticated. But we'll get out to our next show. We'll do that.
I'd enjoy that, John. Thank
Good.
You.
This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we've been talking to Magistrate Judge Hugh Brenneman, who is Magistrate Judge for the Western District of Michigan and also the historian for the Western District of Michigan. We are on every week, several times, on Saturday, on Sunday morning and evening. We are on the on Thursday. So until next time, remember our mantra that if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.